Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Vice President Joe Biden is in Cincinnati, Ohio today to highlight the development of a vacant factory into apartments and retail space using money from President Obama's stimulus funding. But critics there are saying, where are the jobs from that Ohio project? We start today with the gathering storm over the stimulus bill. Rick Klein is senior political reporter for ABC News. So, Rick, Biden is off to Ohio, where polls show President Obama's approval rating slipping below 50%.
That's right, and also approval on handling of the economy slipping. This is a critical battleground state. We hear about it all the time. As Ohio goes, so goes the nation. That's exactly why Joe Biden is in Cincinnati today to try to make that case. They know that it's in states like that that are economically hit very hard. These perceptions around the stimulus are just so key, and that's why they need to go out there and try to make this case. At the same time, you've got some people saying we need more stimulus spending. You've got Republicans saying it's now clear that the first set didn't work. It is a messy situation.
Well, not just Republicans saying that. Many analysts are weighing in on this as well. Did the first stimulus work? Should there be another stimulus plan? And how are you reading the thinking on the Obama administration, Treasury Department, the Fed, and how they're all addressing this?
They're saying we have to wait. But people aren't getting impatient. And I think even inside the administration, they realize that there may be a need for more spending. There may be a need for more stimulus. But politically, it's just not a road they can go down right now. Joe Biden earlier in the week said they misread the economy. But then
he said it again yesterday.
But President Obama said, look, we wouldn't have done anything differently. They're trying to hold off these calls because there's other big agenda items. They're trying to get health care done. That's not going to happen if all of a sudden they're focusing again on stimulus spending.
Well, by the way, how do you read that seeming disconnect between the vice president and the president on just how this economy was read? Is Biden being sent out to say, you know, it was worse under the Bush administration, perhaps, than we thought? Or is he doing another foot in mouth in saying that it was the Obama administration that didn't get it right?
You know, the old definition of a Washington gaffe is when a politician tells the truth by accident. And I think that's what happened here. A lot of folks realize that the economy has gotten worse than anyone thought it would be. The unemployment predictions that the Obama transition team made in January were a misreading of the economy, as it turned out. But it's not like anyone else got it better. So I think Joe Biden conceded the point there that while honest opens a door to a debate that the president just doesn't want to have right now.
We talked about Obama's approval ratings dropping in Ohio. Other polls show independent voters moving away from the president nationally. And in key swing states, there are also reports that Republican candidate recruitment is up. Do the Democrats perhaps own these problems now?
Certainly by the 2010 midterm elections, you can expect the Democrats will own these problems, although we may be in a much different economic environment and political environment by then. Republicans have more of a bounce in their step this week. There's no question about that. But largely as a party, they're still in something of disarray and a rebuilding phase. As you know, there's just been this series of stories with prominent political figures in the Republican Party really making their own messes. And that, I think, is still dominating the larger narrative and the larger discussion, although there's some hopeful signs, no doubt, this week.
And yet you've got talk radio 24 hours a day pounding away at how the stimulus isn't working. And that may be taking effect here. But what about going forward? We were talking about the debate over whether or not there will be a second stimulus. Warren Buffett told Good Morning America today a second stimulus might be needed. He compared the first to taking half a tablet of Viagra and mixing it with candy. I'm not sure what he meant by that.
Sounds unappetizing.
Well, but does the second stimulus have any legs, given that it's more spending?
It does not have serious political legs. Speaker Pelosi just today said she wants to give the first stimulus package a chance to work before you see any more action. They may be there eventually, although something tells me they won't call it a stimulus package. They may find another label for it, and I think they want to put off that kind of consideration for as long as possible. Give this first $787 billion a chance to actually get into the system.
Well, and Rick, on that point, that the stimulus money just doesn't seem to be filtering down to places where it might create jobs. Yesterday on the floor of the House, Representative Adolphus Towns, a New York Democrat, said transportation projects in economically distressed areas were being left out, even though they were supposed to be a priority. And there was also a Government Accountability Office report that was released at the House Oversight Committee hearing yesterday, saying that money that was set aside for building infrastructure, creating jobs, was being used instead to pave roads and bridges. They also were critical in other ways of how stimulus money just isn't getting to jobs. Do you think we're going to see the Obama White House telling states to snap too?
there's going to be a push at every level of government to get this money spent as quickly as possible. There's no one else to blame here. The Obama administration largely wrote the bill with the help of the Democratic Congress, and now they're implementing it. So they've got to do what they can to make sure this money gets out the door as quickly as possible.
Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News, co-host of the network's webcast Top Line. Rick, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, the Obama administration has yet to pass its health care plan, also expected to be expensive and have critics. But today we want to take a look at the rarest and most expensive form of health care. Here in Massachusetts, there's been a focus recently on biotech giant Genzyme, which makes the drug Cerezyme to treat the rare Gaucher disease, which only afflicts an estimated 10,000 people around the world. But as a result, they can't process certain waste, which builds up over time, and they will surely die. Cerezyme cleans the waste out, but they have to take it for the rest of their lives, and it's expensive. And the story of this life-saving drug tells us a lot about both the hope and the high cost of future high-tech treatments. Stephen Heuser recently traveled to Costa Rica for the Boston Globe to report on Genzyme and the drug Cerezyme. We mentioned the relatively few of the world's people who suffer this disease. He found one of these people in Costa Rica, where there's a national health care program. The country pays for its citizens' drug needs, and the list of approved medicines runs 190 pages long. But initially, Cerezyme was not on that list, and then Stephen found Tanya Gonzalez. Stephen joins us in the studio. Stephen, first of all, initially no one knew that Tanya had Gaucher. How sick was she when her family began trying to figure out her problem?
Tanya was a little girl in Costa Rica. This is in the mid-1990s. She was about 3-4 years old, and in the middle of the night, suddenly her parents smelled this horrible smell. They all shared a room. They live in a very small house together.
Her bowels had emptied, and so they took her at the beginning of a trail of taking her to many doctors. No one knew what it was. How was she further affected by this mystery?
She was a normal 3-year-old, normal 4-year-old, and as she grew older, she began to be withered in certain ways. Her limbs were much thinner, but her abdomen became much larger. And what was happening, they didn't know this, what was happening was her body was failing to clear out and process certain kinds of waste.
Right.
And so she was becoming much heavier around the middle. She became like sort of almost barrel-shaped in the middle, and her spine was twisting around as her liver and her spleen got much, much bigger.
So a terrible result of what would later be determined to be Gaucher's disease, but she doesn't know this at the time. Let's pause for a second in her story, because here is where her story intersects with the story of Genzyme's success. The company first came up with a medication for Gaucher's in the 1990s. But you write, no one believed that American insurers would pay for this hugely expensive medication that would help so few people. But what happened?
Well, Genzyme came up with a way to produce a drug that no one had ever been able to do before, which means it could cure a disease that had never been curable.
Right.
But it also was extremely expensive to produce.
And how much? Give us a sense.
The way they set their price, it would end up costing each patient about $200,000 per year on average just to get this drug.
Right.
So for every patient, it was like buying a house every year.
And as we said, people said American insurers are not going to pay for that, but they did.
Yeah, well, it turns out if you have very few patients, insurers are more likely to say yes, because overall, that's not a huge cost for them. And I've talked to a lot of insurers. I was fascinated by the idea that anybody would pay this much money for a drug. And what I discovered was that insurers are much more worried about a drug like Lipitor, you know, where they're paying just, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars a year for the thousands and thousands of people who are taking this drug.
Right.
Rather than a drug that's super expensive for one person, but overall, it's not as big a part of the insurer's cost.
So initially, Genzyme doesn't have to lower the price of the drug because insurers said they would pay for it. They have no competition at that point. But then they begin what is essentially a search for more patients. Tell us about that.
Well, it's a really uncommon disease. And so as soon as you say, well, geez, we have this drug to treat a very uncommon disease, you're tapping into a network of specialists around the world, the only handful of doctors who really understand this disease, and they're the only people who are seeing those patients. And so Genzyme reaches out and says, hey, look, we think we have a cure for this, it gets approved, and suddenly the doctors who treat it all know about it, and they begin to prescribe it. And pretty soon, everybody in the world in an industrialized country who you know about is getting this drug. So to grow their business, there are not a lot more patients being born with this disease, but you can find more in the developing world. You can find more in China or in India. And so Genzyme, which is a very international company, they have divisions around the world, and they began to search all over, all these obscure countries, for new patients.
Well, and the result is that they then, in some cases, have to approach governments about buying this medication for these patients because these are very poor patients.
Right. It's a business. And in most countries, I mean, besides the United States, the way you get your drug paid for is the government pays for the drug. So once they find their patients through their specialists or whichever way they find them, they have to get paid. And so they approach the government or whoever it is about getting paid for their drug.
But they don't ever negotiate. The whole model for Sarazyme from Genzyme is either full price or free?
That's right. Some companies at this point in the history of kind of the pharmaceutical industry provide discounts for drugs in the third world. But this was a result not of the companies voluntarily doing this, but of like huge public protests. I mean, remember the 1990s, early 2000s, there were all these AIDS activists who really pressed companies to donate or to make less expensive drugs available in Africa and India. Genzyme has never been pressured to do this because no one really knows very much about this disease. No one really knows very much about this drug. And, you know, this is true of other biotechnology companies as well. They sell extremely expensive drugs for very few people, and so they're not a big part of the public conversation about drug prices.
Well, so Genzyme is selling it to American insurers, now selling it to governments around the world. And how much is this drug a part of Genzyme's growth?
Genzyme is, to a large extent, the house that Sarazyme built. At this point, it sells more than $1 billion a year, and that's what they call in the industry a blockbuster drug if you hit $1 billion in sales. About half of that they sell overseas. And if you think about it, they're selling this $1 billion-a-year drug to just 5,000 people.
Around the world. And the international sales are so important that you say that in one place, I think it's in the office of the CEO, there's actually a gong.
Yeah, the guy who's he's the head of the international operations, and he's got this, you know, they have souvenirs from all over the world because they've done business in every corner of the earth, and one of the souvenirs is this Chinese gong. And I asked, well, geez, do you ever ring the gong? And they're like, yeah, when we get reimbursement, when a country agrees to pay for one of our drugs, we'll ring the gong.
Well, that brings us back to Tanya in Costa Rica. The doctor finds Tanya, but what does Costa Rica say in response to her family's pleas to pay for her care?
Right. So there's this very dramatic moment in the life of this family where Jose Gonzalez, who's the dad, and his wife Viviana, they're in anguish about their daughter, you know, who's just getting sicker and sicker, and she's 8 and she's unhealthy and they don't know what's wrong, and they've had all these tests, and suddenly a phone call comes and the doctor says, we have an answer. So they sit down with the doctor, they drive to the capital, to the hospital. The doctor says, well, we have a drug that can treat your daughter. We know what she has. The bad news is that it costs $200,000, maybe $300,000 a year. To the family, this is almost an imaginary amount of money.
Right.
It would be to an American family as well. And when the doctor writes a prescription for the drug, the government looks at this prescription and says, we don't have the money to pay for this.
Well, it goes back and forth. There are pleas from the family to please pay for this drug for their child. And ultimately, Genzyme sends advocates to work with the family.
Genzyme has actually hired a healthcare consultant who is working for the company and working with the family as sort of a middleman. So the company wouldn't be seen to be directly involved with the process. That would be kind of unseemly. And what ended up happening was that Costa Rica has a constitution that guarantees every individual the right to healthcare. And so there's a national ombudsman who helps the population sue the government for human rights violations, and he took Tanya's case. And so they sued the government, and they said, this girl has the right to the drug, and we want to force you to pay.
Boston Globe reporter Stephen Heuser. We're going to continue this story after a break here and now. We're speaking with Boston Globe reporter Stephen Heuser about the biotech giant Genzyme, which makes the drug Sarazyme to treat Gaucher disease. Recently, a virus shut down the company's labs here in Massachusetts. While the labs were being cleaned, the FDA has asked a competing company, Protalix, to speed up production of its drug. And patients are waiting nervously because Sarazyme is saving the lives of people like Tanya Gonzalez in Costa Rica. Stephen, as we said, her family couldn't afford the drug. Costa Rica said it couldn't afford it either. Genzyme backed a court battle, forcing the government to pay for it. But did Genzyme ever consider just reducing the cost of the medicine?
They did offer to donate the drug for 2 months, I have asked them about this, and they've said that if the country was unwilling to pay, they would have continued to donate the drug to Tanya. But the offer they made was basically 2 months of free drug while you guys figure out how to pay for it. And they say they will not go down the road of offering some countries the drug at lower prices while charging full price to the United States and industrialized countries.
Because?
I think that, honestly, they made that decision early on in their company history because it just becomes really messy once you're selling it to Honduras for 10% of the price and Costa Rica for 40% of the price and Brazil for 89% of the price. With pharmaceutical companies that sell pills, that essentially can lead to trading of pills across borders. for companies like Genzyme that sell very complex and difficult to administer injection drugs, which is what this is, it's a little harder to see how charging what they call differential prices would lead to some kind of cross-border traffic that cuts into their profits. But really, I think what it is they've decided they need to make X amount of money on the drug to make the profit margin they want. With these profits, they can then pay to donate the drug to super poor countries.
And they do point out that they do give the drugs free to a handful of patients.
Yeah, they have about 300 around the world.
Out of 5,000 and potentially 10,000.
Yeah, about half of those are in China also, where I think they expect that they'll build stronger ties with the government and they'll wind up getting paid.
And some are in countries where they know there's no way that the country's ever going to pay. It's too poor.
Yeah, there's a patient in Guatemala, and I don't think they have any plans that they're ever going to make money in Guatemala. They're just going to donate the drug.
Well, what's their profit margin again? How much are they making?
On the particular product, and this is actually a completely normal profit margin for a drug. Almost every new drug comes out makes about this amount of money, but they make a 90% profit. Why is this the normal profit margin for the drug industry? Because it's not the normal profit margin in other industries. One of the answers, they have to spend a lot of money on research and development because there's a lot of failure. But there's something else about it too, which is that the investors in these companies expect these profit margins because there's a high rate of failure, because drug companies are seen as these sort of like high value investments. They expect very high returns. And so to get those high returns, the companies, they basically price their products that whatever the product costs to make, they make 80 to 90% profit margin on them.
Yeah. And they, I'm assuming, would also say that, sure, they could cut some deals with some governments for the Tanyas of the world.
Yep.
But there's very few places that are going to make that up because there just aren't only so many patients.
That's right. In this case, I mean, if they had 5 million patients, it would not necessarily need to be that expensive.
Well, so now a virus has closed the Genzyme plant temporarily, halted production of Serozyme temporarily,
yeah.
And the FDA is encouraging another company to speed up production of their drug, which one assumes is going to change the landscape somewhat because you have the small patient base and now two companies providing medication, and you have patients that are worried in the interim.
Yeah.
One mother of a 10-month-old says she thinks there should have been a contingency plan. Is that one of the problems with the Genzyme model, that, you know, the good news is you come up with something that's life-saving and incredibly expensive. The bad news is you're the only one.
Yeah, I mean, Genzyme itself is developing a competitor. They're developing a pill because they think that other companies will also be developing pills. So it's possible that in 10 years we will see a few different companies that can provide a drug for this disease. But it's, you know, the one thing about these very sophisticated drugs is that it's very hard to take a patient off of one and switch them to another just for medical reasons. So it's not as easy as switching, yeah, you know, painkillers.
Well, and what about going forward? You spoke to someone in the Ministry of Health in Costa Rica who's been pushing for change in the way drug companies work internationally.
As I mentioned before, there's a decade ago or so, a big international movement arose to sort of pressure drug companies to provide AIDS medications for much less money in developing countries. The focus of that movement now has switched to vaccines and diseases and things that are very prevalent in poor countries. At this point, the amounts of money involved in those and the cost of the sort of global health system is so much higher than the overall cost of these very rare drugs that the attention still hasn't focused on the really rare drugs. And it's possible that down the line you'll see sort of more broadly based agreements internationally just about the cost of new therapies in general. Because, like, America is great at developing, you know, new healthcare therapies, but they also are really good at developing things that no one else can afford. And even we're having increasingly hard time affording them. And so you could see down the line a broad-based agreement, you know, being developed that poorer countries can get access to new therapies for kind of prorated amounts of money, for less, depending on how their GDP per person. But it's going to be a long time coming before it's settled anything besides a case-by-case basis.
Well, that is a suggestion, that drug companies scale their prices to a country's GDP, yeah, so that Costa Rica might pay less than the U.S. but more than Ghana, for
yeah,
instance.
Yeah, sure. That's a really interesting debate. And it's not just important to people in these sort of distant lands, but increasingly it will be to us, because the more and pricier therapies that get developed for new drugs, the more even countries like America are going to have to start making pretty difficult decisions about, you know, how much are we really willing to pay to improve your life by 20% for 1 year and that sort of thing.
Meanwhile, how is Tanya?
She's been doing great. I mean, I don't speak Spanish, and so I've went from the Globe. I've actually had there's been a reporter, Maria Kramer, who's been wonderful about calling down to the family, and she just checked in on them for me a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, her family is just over the moon. I mean, this drug has been a huge success and has completely transformed her life. They really see the hand of God in the form of Genzyme or the doctor or whoever touching them and giving their daughter her life back. It's extraordinary. I mean, she had a 15th birthday party, and her dad said to me, you know, I feel like that was her second birthday, like she was born again as a healthy human being. Mm-hmm. And now she's 17 and she's doing great.
And she's going to have to be on Sarazyme for the rest of her life?
There's a strong likelihood because the drug is needed to continually fix the problem that your body has inside it.
And we understand there's one more child in Costa Rica now.
That's right. There was a new patient was diagnosed with Gaucher disease, and so now they're going to have, and the precedent was set, so the country has already agreed to pay for the drug for the second person, you know, and that's $300,000, $400,000 a year, and maybe there's another disease with five more people, and, you know, these expensive therapies will start to really add up.
Stephen Heuser of the Boston Globe. We'll link you to his writing about the biotech giant Genzyme and the drug Sarazyme at our website, herenow.org. Stephen, thanks so much for coming in to talk to us about it.
Hey, thanks, Robin.
Okay, still ahead today, when same-sex marriage became legal here in Massachusetts, couples thought they'd finally get spousal benefits, but not if you're a mailman, as we'll hear after the news, here and now. Tomorrow marks the day when search teams will stop listening for the audio pings from the black boxes aboard Air France Flight 447. The flight recorders are believed buried deep in the mountainous ocean floor off the coast of Brazil. The audio pings began to fade last week, and with them, hope of finding out exactly what caused the Airbus A330 to crash during a thunderstorm on May 31st, killing all 228 people on board. Dan Michaels has been covering the story for The Wall Street Journal, and he joins us with what researchers have learned. So, Dan, the French Navy deployed a nuclear sub to search for these flight recorders. The U.S. Navy sent state-of-the-art underwater listening devices. But is the area just too big and too deep?
Essentially, yes. I was trying to figure out what this equates to, and I thought maybe it's something like finding a cricket in a crowded train station. Mm. The water there is mountainous, as you said. It's deep. The pingers have a range of maybe a mile. So it means that these microphones that they're dragging behind boats, they really got to be within spitting distance of the thing.
Yeah.
And that just has been a momentous task.
And as you say, the water's deep. It's 10 miles deep. And so it could be 10 miles down, not to mention across a swath of water. Well, wreckage from the aircraft has been discovered. More than 50 bodies have been recovered. And we understand that from autopsies, people may learn, you know, if there were bone fractures or burn marks. They may learn a little bit about the crash, but we've been hearing reports about a possible malfunctioning of the plane's speed sensors. Tell us more about what analysts speculate here.
The speed sensors on the plane, which are little hook-like things that stick out under the cockpit, the model on this Airbus had a history of malfunctioning and giving faulty speed readings. Just a couple of weeks ago, another plane, a Northwest Airlines Airbus A330, had a similar problem. But this should not cause a plane to crash.
Well, you mentioned the Northwest Airlines A330 that had problems a couple of weeks ago, flying, I believe, from Hong Kong to Tokyo. And they tell a frightening story of the pilot ultimately taking over the controls. And this has raised questions about the readiness of pilots to cope when computer systems fail. Is that one of the questions that's come up? Again, it's speculation, but one of the questions that's come up after the Air France crash?
Yes. Over the past 10 or 20 years, planes have gotten a lot more automated. The sophistication of the computers is really amazing. And generally, they've made flying much safer. But the problem is, one, when they go wrong, they can really go wrong. And when they go wrong, often pilots don't know why they're going wrong. These systems are much more robust than what you get on a computer. So this is not Windows crashing on you. Still, the pilots have come to rely on them, especially the younger generation of pilots that grew up flying with computers, didn't grow up actually feeling the feel of an airplane as you did on older planes, have a lot to learn here.
Well, we understand crash investigators are also grappling with another question, why the plane was reported missing a full 7 hours after its last radio contact. And there's a dispute between air traffic controllers in Brazil and their colleagues in Senegal because planes are passed off from controllers in one zone to the next. And there's question as to whether or not there was communication between the controllers in Brazil and Senegal and the plane. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
The Brazilians say they told the Senegalese. The Senegalese say that they were never told. The Brazilians released a tape of what they say is a handoff. I've listened to it. It sounds like, if it's correct, you know, that the Brazilians are saying it. The Senegalese controller sounds a bit distracted, hard to say exactly what happened here. My guess is that the plane may simply have fallen between the cracks. And for all we know, this kind of thing may happen a lot, and we only became aware of it because this one crashed.
Well, that's certainly disturbing. Is there a move to sort of ensure that if it did literally fall between the cracks, that doesn't happen again?
Things like this, when they're identified, there are efforts to fix them. But African aviation, it's gotten a lot of attention lately, but like a lot of Africa, you know, it doesn't have a lot of resources. A lot of the good people in African aviation have been hired away by rich countries in the Persian Gulf. On the other side, Brazil has had big problems with air traffic control over recent years. Air traffic control was partly to blame for a mid-air collision over the Amazon a couple of years ago. Not every country has absolutely perfect air traffic control, and ultimately, at least for the next couple of decades probably, air traffic control is human, and people do make mistakes.
Dan Michael of the Wall Street Journal. Dan, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
All right, we'll be back in 30 seconds with new lawsuits challenging the federal marriage law here and now. Massachusetts, the first state to declare same-sex marriage legal, has now become the first state to sue the federal government over its Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, which defines marriage as the union between a man and a woman. Massachusetts is arguing that the 1996 DOMA law intrudes on states' rights and forces the state to discriminate against its 16,000 same-sex couples because the law denies spouses federal benefits, for instance, the right for the same-sex spouse of a veteran to be buried in a veteran cemetery. The Massachusetts suit is one of a series challenging DOMA. Earlier this year, the group Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders, or GLAAD, sued on behalf of eight same-sex couples and three surviving spouses. Nancy Gill is one of those plaintiffs. She's from Bridgewater, Massachusetts. Nancy, welcome.
Thank you.
And we understand after 24 years together, you married your partner, Marcel, in 2004. Did you think, first of all, that that protected you when it came to benefits?
Absolutely. I thought that when once we got married on a Friday, I went right to my personnel office on Monday and applied to put Marcel on my health insurance. Since we had been paying for two plans, we have two children, and I already had a family plan, and she had a single plan. So once we were legally married, I just figured, okay.
But you're a postal worker. That's a federal job. What'd you find out?
I found out that because of the Defense of Marriage Act and the way that that's written, particularly Section 3, which defines marriage as between a man and a woman, my marriage was not valid under the federal government.
So you can't add Marcel to the family plan?
No. I tried 3 days after we got married in 2004, and then I've tried again at open season time, which is at the end of the year, just to see if maybe things have changed. And I was denied. I tried using, like, just the computer. Big red light would flash up. You are not eligible. It was like being a game show contestant, and I was a loser.
Well, in addition to the money you say you lose because you're paying for extra health insurance, what other federal benefits won't you or Marcel get?
Well, I also pay into a pension plan, which I have been paying into since 1987. If something happens to me when I am retired or even right now, my legally married wife and the person that I love, that we have taken care of each other all these years, would be entitled to none of those benefits.
Well, Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council, a strong defender of the Defense of Marriage Act, says that taxpayers face the very real possibility of being forced to subsidize same-sex marriages if the Defense of Marriage Act is overturned. In other words, his point is, why should taxpayers in states that already turned down same-sex marriage at the polls be forced to send their federal tax dollars to, in effect, support your marriage?
Well, I disagree with that, mainly because I, too, am a taxpayer, and Marcel is a taxpayer. We have a teenage daughter who now works part-time who's a taxpayer. We're all paying taxes, and my marriage is just as important and just as valid as my neighbor's marriage, as somebody in another state's marriage. We're not asking for other states to recognize our marriage. We're asking for the federal government to recognize our marriage.
Nancy Gill, postal employee from Bridgewater, Massachusetts, and part of a lawsuit challenging the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. Nancy, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, let's now turn to Gary Busek. He's GLAAD's legal director. Gary, as we said, Massachusetts filed a suit claiming, in effect, that the federal law DOMA trumps their state rights. What's the basis of the GLAAD suit, your suit?
Our lawsuit comes at this from the perspective of individual married couples who are married in Massachusetts and then have sought the Social Security benefits, employment-related benefits, or filing your taxes as married, filing jointly.
So your lawsuit claims discrimination, but your quick response to the points your opponents make, should people in other states, through their tax dollars, send benefits to Massachusetts same-sex couples if they don't support same-sex marriage?
Yeah, you know, I think, Robin, that's a total red herring because the law has always taken the position that each of us as individual citizens are not allowed to pick and choose where our tax dollars go and object to it. I mean, we've had a lot of people who have objected over the years to various wars and have thought that they should be able to withhold the percentage of their income tax, say, that funded the Vietnam War or that funded the more recent Iraq War. And the answer to that legally is, well, no, we don't have the right to do that. Our plaintiffs are taxpayers, and they are paying their taxes. They're paying into Social Security. So it really seems to be wrong to suggest you're not entitled to the very same benefits that every other married couple gets.
Well, in fact, the state is pointing out that under DOMA, while Massachusetts couples get state benefits, the state would actually lose federal funding for MassHealth, which is the state's Medicaid program, if they gave those benefits to same-sex couples. And they'd also lose federal Veterans Affairs funding if they allowed the spouse of a veteran in a same-sex marriage to be buried in a veteran's cemetery.
Yeah, and isn't that crazy? Massachusetts has one class of married people. And so if a heterosexual veteran comes and says, I want to be buried and my spouse wants to be buried here, the state says, fine. If a same-sex married couple, one of them a veteran, comes and says, I want to be buried here along with my spouse, the Massachusetts wants to say, well, absolutely, yes, we treat everybody equally. And yet the federal government tells Massachusetts, well, don't you dare do that, because otherwise we're going to take all the money away that we gave you.
Well, in defending the DOMA law in general, the Justice Department pointed out that there are other kinds of marriages that states have had the right to say we don't recognize. The department cited an uncle and a niece legally married in Italy but not considered legal in Connecticut, a 16-year-old married legally in Indiana, but that marriage wasn't legal in New Jersey. Now, at the time, critics went wild because they thought that the Obama Justice Department had just compared incest and marriage to children to same-sex marriage. But do you buy the argument that there should be ways for states to not recognize certain marriages?
Oh, you know, and that's absolutely true, Robin, and I think we don't disagree with that here at GLAAD, and nor does the Commonwealth. We're not asking any other state to respect. This is a question of the federal government. And the federal government has always looked at the states to tell them whether someone is married or not.
What do you think about the Obama administration tactic of wanting DOMA to be dealt with legislatively through Congress, not through the White House, and still through the Justice Department defending it?
Well, I think they're finding their sea legs here, and I think they saw in the reaction to the brief they filed in the first DOMA challenge, and I think they thought they were doing something better than the Bush administration had done, and I guess that's partially true. But they made some arguments, like this taxpayer argument that Tony Perkins has latched onto, that are, I think, simply legally wrong, totally nutty, and absolutely reflect a position that doesn't understand the discrimination that's being undertaken by this law. Hopefully they're going to get better.
Gary Busek, legal director for the group Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders, GLAAD, talking about recent challenges to the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. Gary, thanks so much.
Sure, Robin.
Iraq is one of the most heavily mined countries in the world, and improvised explosive devices, or IEDs, are responsible for the majority of American combat deaths. The primary defense against them, another acronym, Explosive Ordnance Disposal Squads, or EODs. The new film, The Hurt Locker, tells the story of a fictional EOD squad. Jeremy Renner plays Staff Sergeant William James, leader of a very active team.
How many bombs have you disarmed?
I'm not quite sure, sir.
Sergeant.
Yes.
I asked you a question.
873, sir.
873. 873.
They're counting today, sir, yes.
That's got to be a record.
The Hurt Locker was written by Mark Boal, who was embedded with the U.S. Army Bomb Squad in 2004, and it's directed by Catherine Bigelow, who filmed it in neighboring Jordan. Here now's Emiko Tamagawa caught up with Catherine when she was in Boston recently, and she asked her what drew her to this story.
I'm definitely drawn toward characters or situations that can be very evocative and provocative and create a kind of something that I call sort of experiential cinema. In this case, with The Hurt Locker, it allows you to be put on the ground a day in the life of a bomb tech. Boots on the ground, you are there, fly on the wall, look at what it might be like to be a bomb tech in Baghdad in 2004.
I want to talk to you about the central characters. There is William James, who is the actual bomb tech, and he's also sort of the new guy on this squad. There's Sanborn, and there's Eldridge. And it's very interesting to see over the course of the film how they develop a relationship, because right at the beginning, you can really see James is a fish out of water with his guys.
Well, he's the new guy. He's thrust into a situation because the former team leader met with a fairly catastrophic demise, and James has a very unusual combination of both a kind of reckless bravado, sort of a swagger and hubris, if you will, but with a profound skill set.
There's a scene where he has underneath his bunk parts of all these bombs that he's diffused, and it's the puzzle that seems to really, really appeal to him.
Uh-huh. This one. This one. From the UN building. Flaming car, dead man switch, boom. This guy was good, I like him. This one, y'all, is from our first call together. This box is full of stuff that almost killed me.
Every single IED, improvised explosive device, is prototypical. There are no two alike. There's no playbook. Especially in 2004, it was a Wild West. It was the sort of dawn of bombs being the epicenter of this particular conflict. So all of a sudden, EOD, Explosive Ordnance Disposal, is thrust right into center stage, right into the crosshairs of this war. There wasn't a ground-to-ground, air-to-ground. There's not a hill that has to be taken. It's everywhere and completely invisible. You know, in other words, all of these IEDs are disguised actually rather cleverly. So I think of him as kind of an artist, you know, looking each time at a blank canvas, how shall I treat it this time? Is it the red wire? Is it the watch strapped to the side of the bomb? Is this a pressure-activated explosive device? Is it a decoy meant to distract my attention from the real device, which is 5 feet away to my left? I think these men have the most dangerous job in the world, and yet because of the military today, it's a volunteer military. They've chosen this particular profession.
Hey, Eldridge, looks like we're going to need a charge.
Oh, I got that. Figured 4 blocks. That'll give us about 20 pounds of bang total.
That blast is going to roll straight out there. The shell will probably kick out there. Most of the shrapnel is going to shoot straight up in a beautiful umbrella pattern.
Yep.
We're going to get some smaller pieces and shell fragments this way, but we'll be okay if we're behind the Humvee. You bring the box back, we'll load it up.
No problem.
The screenplay was written by Mark Boal, who wrote In the Valley of Elah. That was one of the films, and there have been a number of films that have addressed the Iraq War. A lot of those films, for a lot of reasons, haven't done well. Some people thought, is it too soon, or you know, are they trying to you know tell us too much? I mean, when you address a subject like the Iraq War, how do you make sure you know in a fiction film that you tell a story that people still want to see?
Well, I think that. Although I think it's a really extraordinary movie, Valley of Elah, but I think that, like many of the films that have somewhat similar subject matter, a reintegration into the home front from the effects of this particular conflict. And I think where The Hurt Locker is, it makes a kind of departure, is it's a combat movie. Our desire was to get in theater for specifically bomb techs in Baghdad in 2004 to really make it concrete. Unless you're a member of the military or maybe in the front lines or even have firsthand knowledge of an EOD tech, you don't really understand what a day in their life might be like. And they're not there as aggressors. They're there to save lives. You know, they're there to render safe these devices. And in doing so, hundreds, if not thousands, of lives are saved. And all of a sudden, you're kind of in brand new territory.
I wanted to ask you just a couple of questions about you as a filmmaker, because one thing in reading about you is realizing that you came to filmmaking from the visual arts, which made me think of one scene that just took me aback when I was watching it, and it was when I believe James was defusing a bomb, and it's very close in, and he's very closely working on it, and then it pulls back, and as it pulls back, you start to see all the parts and the magnitude of it, and it is both beautiful and terrifying. But do you think your background as an artist sort of shapes you as a filmmaker when you...
I think for sure it shapes me. It certainly, I don't think I would even know how to begin to approach a scene like that if I didn't have it. It certainly helps me break it down to have had the visual art background, because it allows me to sort of focus almost exclusively on story and character. I think the visuals come fairly naturally, and so that allows me a lot more emphasis on character, which I think is where all good stories reside.
I wanted to ask you about a particular scene. There's this Iraqi who's been sort of made into an unwitting suicide bomber, and James is trying to defuse, and he's shouting, everybody's shouting. It's this chaos.
There's too many locks. There's too many. I can't do it. I can't get it off. I'm sorry, okay? You understand? I'm sorry.
Let go of me.
You hear me? I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Get down.
That was a very emotional sequence to shoot. The Iraqi actor actually was a refugee from the occupation. In fact, he actually was a fairly well-known stage actor in Baghdad. So the opportunity to act again, he was very, very excited. He's so talented, has such a magnificent face. But we shot that sequence, and at the end of the day, when I said wrap, everybody usually, on any given natural normal day, would grab their equipment and head for the hotel. But everybody was dead still, and they all had, you know, tears in their eyes. It was a very, very, very moving shoot, that sequence.
Some soldiers have seen this film. Can you talk just a little bit about how they've reacted?
Extraordinary reactions. In fact, we showed it to the EOD, Explosive Ordnance Disposal community, and basically, I mean, the members that I've spoken to, they sort of felt like every other sector of the military has had their film. Like, you've had a Navy SEAL film, you've had Top Gun, you've had this and that, but EOD has never had their moment on the screen. And if there was ever a moment as a result, sadly, of this conflict, this is their moment.
Director Catherine Bigelow's new film is The Hurt Locker. She spoke with Here and Now's Emiko Tamagawa. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.